From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I guess we should have assumed that Lorraine Nicholson would have loved the Playboy Club, because in a short profile of her in Vanity Fair, she mentioned their best friends were Hugh Hefner's sons, and she would go there because she would get pounds of peas and mashed potatoes. She eventually went on to write a terrific piece about encountering life as a young person at the Playboy Mansion. It's in the current Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair. My guest before she sails off to parts unknown is sitting across from me. It's Lorraine Nicholson. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
It really is this kind of awakening and the scales falling from your eyes. I was thinking about your short film, which is also about a similar thing for people coming basically into adulthood. Mm-hmm. And I wonder why that period seems to mean so much to you in terms of writing about it.
I think part of it is it's the part of life that I feel I can speak with authority about because I've lived it. I'm still a relatively young person, and it would feel strange to wrestle with themes that I don't understand, I guess. And for me, I'm always looking for a level of truth in my work, I think.
I think more honesty than truth, because that short is about people being forced to be honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. And in that piece on going to the Playboy Mansion as a child, it's about people being forced to be honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. And you having to be honest with yourself. And you say truth, but I'm wondering, I'm not trying to put too fine a point on it, but is it honesty versus truth?
I mean, I guess honesty versus truth. Honesty is more subjective, I suppose. And so, yes, I think honesty is more accurate, because in the piece in Vanity Fair and in my short film, I think all of these different truths can coexist while not necessarily pointing towards the same objective truth. And that kind of moral ambiguity is the world that I grew up in, and I think the world that we all live in on a certain level.
But also, given your viewpoint, your perspective, you really have a take on presentation versus real person that few people have access to.
Yes. As I explained to you, I grew up in L.A., and I am a Hollywood kid. And from the very beginning, I understood that there was a difference between how, for example, my parents acted at home and how they acted publicly. And I think a big part of that is protecting themselves. You know, I think that if you go out there as a raw nerve, honestly, I think it's very hard to survive in this town. I think there is a level of veneer that's required to survive.
Also, I just found myself thinking about this place. You describe it where there was no sadness or hurt or anger. I mean, it really sounds like the Garden of Earthly Delights. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I think Hef was a creator of worlds. And often, you know, for me, I felt incredibly safe there. And a lot of people didn't have that experience. And that's to your point about honesty versus truth. Like, I think that, you know, the people who had a hard time there, that's those experiences can live on top of and coexist with my experience of it being one of, you know, safety. And I think, you know, when you think about somebody building a world, it's like, yes, you know, I think Hef did have this utopian vision that he carried out to the end. And I think if you don't fit into that, it can be very uncomfortable. But for me as a child, it was this, you know, paradise, because there was this youthfulness to it that even the adults there had, you know. And then you have the animals and the rolling grounds and the castle. I mean, it really did feel like growing up in a Disney movie.
It's so funny, because all these things you're saying just are triggering things for me in the piece. You were talking about how for lots of kids, your first danger with an animal is almost being nipped by a dog, but yours was almost being nipped by
a peacock. Yes. You know, because as a kid, you sort of go toddling up to animals and this peacock, you know, it's the feathers plume out, and birds can be vicious.
Yes, probably many things can be vicious. We're talking to my guest, Lorraine Nicholson, her terrific piece on growing up and spending time as a kid at the Playboy Mansion is in the current Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair. But you even started off as being about recognizing truth versus honesty with an Easter egg hunt. I mean, there's so much about the way you position the piece about having both a generous and a jaundiced view of the iconic.
Yeah. You know, the way that I pitched the article to Vanity Fair, and I was like, my view of this is kind of doing like a Stand By Me type story, but set at the Playboy Mansion, where you have this group of kids doing kids stuff up against these really adult themes. And that's what it felt like. So there were periods at the Playboy Mansion that were incredibly boring and not exciting at all, because we were kids and kids get bored, even if you are in this, you know, adult paradise that people would kill to be at, especially at that time. But we got jaded because we were kids, and that's what kids do, I think.
Yeah, but your version of being jaded is finding out that the Easter egg hunt was rigged. It's a different thing entirely.
True. Well, that was not a boring moment. That was a shattering moment, because, you know, I had this idea that, as I write in the piece, that the mansion is this basically Garden of Eden. I mean, I write in the piece, you know, because I grew up non-religious. And so when I later found out about Adam and Eve in their garden, I thought of them living somewhere like the Playboy Mansion. Like, I really did see it as this mythical place. And so when this idea, essentially what happened is that when I was around 11 years old, every single year at the mansion, they do an Easter egg hunt. Like, the eggs, they're blown out by hand by the butlers and staff. And, you know, it's hundreds of people searching the grounds for these eggs. And essentially what happened is that one year, my best friends at the mansion, Marston and Cooper, they cheated.
I would say these are half-sons.
Yes, and these are half-sons. And I remember in that moment kind of realizing, like, oh, these little boys are becoming men. And if they're becoming men, that means that I'm becoming a woman. And for me, that was something that was so incredibly horrifying, because at the mansion at that time, from my perspective, there was no really room for women. And so I was like, how am I going to fit into this place? Am I going to be cast out of the garden, essentially? So it was like a real coming of age moment that you sort of pointed to.
But it's also, too, there's so much that is about this sort of trickiness of this, the intersection between being childlike and being childish. And that's one of those moments. But I also thought there's these moments of that fascinate me, like you're seeing Shel Silverstein there, who most of us don't think of as being a part of the Playboy Mansion, but he was actually, if you look at read the magazine, which apparently you never did according to the piece, he was very close to Hugh Hefner. And so You got a chance to encounter him almost in his natural habitat, Shel Silverstein.
Completely. And he was a regular there. And I remember him being one of the few men there who were really willing to, like, walk around in a bathing suit. And I was like, who is this guy? Like, the audacity, you know, there's all these beautiful women and here's this guy with, like, bald and hairy chest. I'm like, what is he doing? And later I found out that he was Shel Silverstein, who wrote these books that even as a girl I admired so much. And I was like, oh, I understand why he has this bravery. It's because he is a genius.
I would imagine, too, on some level, that his work probably influenced you, because it's also about growing up.
Yes.
And being forced to reckon with the idea of the world being a compromised place.
Yes. I mean, now I can put words to this as an adult, but I was really fascinated by surrealism when I was a child, because I knew that deep down, even though it was my status quo, I knew that I was living this kind of warped experience, that, like, my childhood wasn't normal. And I loved the way that he sort of would write about nonsense. Like, I always think about the poem Falling Up that he wrote. Like, that's how my life kind of felt as a kid, you know, I write in the piece too that my favorite songs were like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, or I love Strawberry Fields. Like, I loved that kind of like surrealist Alice in Wonderland thing, because I felt like I was living it.
It's so interesting, and I wonder at what point you realized that you were a writer, because you mentioned in the piece that you said at one point you wanted to be an actress, mm-hmm. not because you wanted to do that, because you had no interest in that, but that beautiful women who had access to everything, I'm quoting the line, wanted to be actresses.
Yeah.
So you wanted to be beautiful, therefore you wanted to be an actress.
Exactly. I mean, I have aspirations to make movies now, but I actually came to my love of movies fairly late in life because I was rebelling and my dad liked movies. And
we should say who your dad is.
Yeah, my father is Jack Nicholson, who likes movies. I like the way I'm like, my dad likes movies. I'm like, that's a very nice way of putting it. So my dad is like over, up on Mulholland Drive liking movies. And I'm like, well, this is boring. My dad likes movies. But what I did like is, you know, I saw these women who were so revered, and it all seemed like, you know, they had these acting aspirations. And I'm like, well, if these, you know, Playboy bunnies want to be an actress, so do I. And so even though I didn't care about movies, I had that aspiration, but I always was writing. I'm the first person in my dad's family to graduate from college. And so I wanted to be an actor even when I was a kid, and my family very much was like, no, they barred me from acting professionally as a child, which now I understand as an adult, but at the time was devastating. And my father very much was like, I really want you to go to college. And I was always very bookish. And I was always writing and I was always reading.
And your dad's a big reader.
And that's actually how we first connected. So it's very strange. Like, if I ever hang out with 80-year-olds, like, well, I actually had the fortune of meeting Francis Ford Coppola, and we have the exact same taste in books, because my dad, that's how we would bond. We would go to his bookshelf and he'd be like, okay, now you're reading Herman Hesse, The Glass Bead Game, or now you're reading Mishima. And so that was like a real thing that we shared together.
This piece is almost like you telling stories in it to keep yourself sane because of all the things that are going on around, because you're in a surrealist Boschscape almost.
Yeah.
Completely. And telling yourself stories is a way to sort of be able to concentrate on what's happening in front of you, because otherwise the world is too crazy.
Yeah, and I was such a reader growing up. I mean, I really, really loved reading and escaping into these different worlds. And I went to elementary school at the center on La Cienega and Melrose down there. And I went back to my elementary school, and the only teacher there still was my first grade teacher. And I went up to him and I was like, you know, Lauren, I really feel like my love of learning saved my life. And I just want to say thank you so much. And, you know, I've now become friends with my other first grade teacher, and we're neighbors and we hang out all the time. But, you know, I really do feel like my love of reading, like, was such a big part in my upbringing.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break and talk more about storytelling to save one's life. My guest is Lorraine Nicholson. She has a terrific piece on growing up, spending time at the Playboy Mansion, in the current Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment, not far from where she lives. There's more to come. Stay with us. I've done this for a while, apparently, according to my guest. Lorraine Nicholson has a terrific piece on perspective, I think, in the current issue of Vanity Fair, the Hollywood issue. It's about growing up and spending time at the Playboy Mansion as a child and sort of the discontents that come from something like that. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. There's a certain point where when you write, you have a recognition that this is what the world looks like to me. And I'm imagining you kept journals of that period. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what it's like as you're starting to write this piece to look back and transport yourself back in time to that person who was writing those journals.
Well, such a cool part about it was I actually did a lot of research for this piece. And so I reached out to a lot of people who I knew at the mansion to kind of like share memories. And that was such a big part of it too, was like reconnecting to these people who I really haven't seen in some cases over a decade, and just sharing
like
that
Allison
experience.
And Joel, who you mentioned.
Yes, like Allison and Joel, who I went to interview them, and they have 11 cats and I'm allergic. But I was so excited to connect with them that I was sneezing wildly during, I mean, if you listen to my tapes of the interviews, I'm like sneezing and sniffling, but I'm so thrilled to be in their company again that I don't even care.
This is what I'm asking, is a chance to reconnect with that person. What was it like to go back and find her again?
It's funny. I feel like I was more myself at that age than I was as a 16 or even 18-year-old. I really feel like I was so in touch with my essential self, even as a child. I was very precocious in that way. And then as a teenage girl, I kind of got into boys and lip gloss and whatever that was.
And Ja Rule.
Yeah, and Ja Rule. And so I do think that it is a kind of return to, I feel very much the same person as I was at that time.
But I guess that's what I'm asking, was like to go back and see that person again, because, and there's a part that's really almost heartbreaking when you write about trying to be like those women, but they were aging up. So as you were trying to age up to be like them and to dye your hair blonde and to tan yourself, they were chasing another kind of perfection. And it's just, it could be, oh my gosh, it could be something out of Hesse, basically chasing the sunrise.
Yeah. I think that a really cool part about doing all these interviews for the piece was also validating my experience, because I think I only experienced it as a child. And so there is this tendency, or at least I have this tendency, of being like, well, maybe I was just a kid and it didn't really happen that way. And so actually going back and talking about the experience of living there with all of these different people who I shared that time with was ultimately so validating. And I had so much compassion for that little girl who had those aspirations to be beautiful, but wasn't that in this conventional Playboy way. And one of the most interesting things actually was one of Hef's sons, Marston, he is actually also a writer now. And I expressed that that's the way that I felt to him. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, we all had crushes on you. Like, you were beautiful. Like, what are you pulling at? And I think, you know, my experience was very much in line with, you know, as I call the girls, the playmates that I spent time with, which is like always chasing this unattainable goal and therefore never being satisfied.
It's funny because there's this constant motion, this pursuit, this anxiety that runs throughout the piece, except when you write about Hef, who has this kind of gravitational pull. But there's also a sadness in that too, because as you mentioned, I think it's Cooper who says in the piece, my dad had really bad judgment about people.
Yeah.
But he represented, as you were saying in the first half of the show, almost a kind of modesty in that he knew who he was and was so fixed on routine that things never changed around him.
I think Hef, in my imagination and my experience, occupied almost like a Gatsby-ish Boo Radley place in my life, because he was such a character and so remote in this way. But I also knew that he cared and was taking care of us. You know, so he did have this larger-than-life persona, but I never really was able to connect to him as a person. And I think a lot of people who spent quality time with Hef feel that way. And I think part of that is being this public figure, as we kind of talked about, that like this desire to protect one's essential self. And I think when you are that level of fame, protect one's essential self, even from the people that you're closest with.
The last section of that piece is really about sort of being fully awakened. And it sort of starts where somebody who's close to Hef is passing away. And that also that need of his to remain childlike and isolated.
Yeah.
At one point, I mean, there's a line that really sort of struck me when the news that she was slipping away from cancer was delivered to him, and before they were to have one of those screenings, he just goes, well, let's not let it ruin the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really powerful moment, Lorraine.
Yeah, it's funny. That's like the one part of the piece that I actually almost cut out, and the editors were very much like, it's actually very important to understand what's going on.
Why did you want to cut it out?
Because I felt like it made Hef, it's not a good story about Hef. I thought it made him seem kind of heartless in a way.
I didn't think heartless as much as just trying to keep that essential.
Exactly.
Part. I mean, trying to keep himself from being wounded too, if he's trying to keep others from being wounded.
Exactly.
He's trying to hide the hurt.
Yeah.
But it felt cold to you at first?
I was worried that it would read that way. And I think the reason why ultimately I decided to keep it is, like, again, I see Hef as like a builder of worlds, a builder of utopias. And I think typically whenever human beings try to build a utopia, it becomes problematic on some level. In the piece, I compare the mansion a lot to Disneyland. And I heard a fact about Disneyland, which is that no one is allowed to die on the premises of Disneyland. If you're having a heart attack, they'll carry you off the property to expire, essentially. And that's very much what the mansion felt like, too, right? Which is like, we're going to block out anything bad and anything evil. And I think as a child, that's why it felt so incredibly safe, because that was an ongoing project, you know? And I also think that's why later, you know, people who were there felt very controlled, which it makes perfect sense because it was a place that was controlled and controlling.
No, it was a manufactured environment. That last third of the, though, is really the curtains being opened on that manufacture when the Hefner's marriage is ending. Mm-hmm. Also, you deal with his sons as grown-ups and talking about actually them having perspectives that shocked me to hear. Did you have any idea that they were that thoughtful about what went on at the place?
Yeah, I mean, part of what inspired me to write this piece was Marston Hefner appeared on the podcast of Holly Madison, who is one of Hef's ex-girlfriends, who wrote this book that was actually quite critical of Hef.
That's a very politic way of putting it. It was critical, not only that, but the entire life. She basically sort of likens it to being in a cult.
Yeah. And I actually reached out to her. I sent her this article just saying, you know, I want you to know that this existed. And I had heard this episode of her podcast, and it actually was part of what inspired me to write the piece. And she actually put it on her Instagram. She's very supportive of the piece, too, which I'm very proud of, because, you know, her experience wasn't mine. But she is a very open-minded person that, like, these two experiences can coexist and one doesn't invalidate the other. But part of what inspired me to write this piece was she invited Marston onto her podcast. And honestly, it's one of the most incredible and healing pieces of content for me post the Me Too era, in which it is two people who see this situation on totally opposite sides of the spectrum, the aisle, whatever you want to put it, who are just really listening to each other and validating each other's experience. And I was like, whoa, if these two people can do this, like, I can too. It was really inspiring.
It's the treatment we're talking about. Parting the Veil with my guest, Lorraine Nicholson. It was a terrific piece on being very, very close to the Playboy Mansion as a child in the current Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair. You can also read the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But as a woman, you're writing about this place that had a mystique when you were a child that was still lionized. And you grew up in the same way the world grew up, and that place did not. You had to ask yourself questions about writing the piece about this place that meant something to you, understanding what it meant to people such as the women who had a different experience of it than you did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the way that America feels about sex is the way that they typically feel about the Playboy Mansion. I think, you know, Hef has always been a lightning rod for controversy throughout the entire history, starting, you know, way back when he started the magazine to present day. And I mean, it'll be curious to see how people feel about Hef's legacy in 10 years. I don't really know, because it continues to change. And that's what's kind of so fascinating about it to me, and why I think it was so important to ground this piece in my point of view, because I can't really tell the future. I don't know how, you know, we'll feel about the politics of the Playboy Mansion, but I do know that my subjective reality as a child was this. And I'm happy to share it with people, because I do think that, at least in terms of like coming into womanhood, I do think that there is something universal there.
I wonder, I was asking about looking back at the journals and seeing that version of yourself in that period, if you feel like she was seeing all the things that she needed to see.
I write in the article a little bit that I had no interest in sex or sexuality whatsoever. I was like constantly wearing blinders because I was very protective of myself. Like, I didn't want to see anything that I wasn't supposed to see. And it took me a very long time to actually come into myself as a woman, because I was afraid.
Of?
I think I had a little bit of that puritanical American thing that we all have, which is sex and sexuality is bad. And yet I also understood that I was growing up in a place that was hypersexualized.
But also commodified.
Exactly. I remember I watched the movie Despicable Me, and that's very much how I felt like growing up with my dad was, right? Which is like, it is this big-hearted thing, but in the animated film Despicable Me, he'll open up a closet and it'll be like filled with bombs, and the little kids are kind of, you know, falling around. And that's like what it felt like at my house, right? Which is like, it wasn't a place for kids, but it was still incredibly warm-hearted, and I felt very supported there, as I did at the mansion. And I think the mansion is also a very good foil for my experience with my own parents.
Again, I'm really taken with the writing.
Thank you.
Having gone from the pivot of thinking about it as a fictional piece where you could protect yourself and patch yourself, to being so incredibly honest about yourself. And as we read it, we see you growing up in the piece. Mm. And it's also about the end of an era. Mm. And the end of an era for that version of you, but also for that version of what the world was, what Playboy was, the way celebrity was viewed at the time, the kind of protection that celebrity gave you at one point. What's it like for you to read this truthful version, not to write it, because you get lost in the process of writing. What's it like to read it?
I feel like these days it's really clear that we've made so many positive steps forward in this kind of post-Me Too era. And I think there are so many more opportunities for different people from different walks of life, especially with the sexual politics in the workplace. Like, all of these things are so incredibly positive. And I myself even feel the gains that have come from this, like, social upheaval. But I think a big part of what I'm trying to communicate in the piece is, like, yes, there are all of these gains, but pausing for a second to ask what has been lost. And I do think that, you know, these things aren't balanced. Like, the gains obviously far outweigh what's lost. But I do think that the piece for me was saying goodbye to a certain kind of way of life that, you know, doesn't exist anymore. I don't think that somebody could start a Playboy mansion today. And so I think that's what you're picking up on. I think there is part of the piece that feels like a farewell for me.
And I wonder if it was hard for you, just because you've got to say also, are you saying goodbye to that person? Because maybe especially getting a chance to look back at her now, she's the essential version of you that exists today.
I think it's more like embracing that person, you know, embracing that person who felt like an outsider and so desperately wanted to fit in, and instead being like, wow, I had this dream to be this certain kind of woman, and I was never that. And I write in the piece, you know, I would be offended that the girls would leave me out of their conversation about bloating or the men that were disappointing me. But I think ultimately there was something of them, of my parents, of my community that I grew up with that wanted more for me. And I couldn't see that at the time, but I can see that now. So I think instead of a goodbye, I think it is like an embrace of that outsider, because ultimately that outsider position is the person who gives me my point of view. And I feel incredibly grateful for that.
Oh, I'm grateful that you did this. My guest is Lorraine Nicholson. Her terrific piece, which I think she should turn into a book.
I do actually have those aspirations. I kind of want to do like 100 years of solitude at the Playboy Mansion and do like each generation of woman until, you know, the mansion basically disappears into the jungle and everyone has pigtails.
Well, we just pitched a book for her. It's the current version of this piece exists in the Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Lorraine, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
That was writer, not actor, writer Lorraine Nicholson. And her article, titled Playmates, looks back at the time she spent as a child behind the gates of the Playboy Mansion. Playmates runs in the 2024 Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair. Another look in Hollywood through the eyes of Oscar-nominated costume designer Ellen Marochnik, whose work has helped two Oscar-winning actors, including Cillian Murphy. Points of view of Hollywood and other points of interest, yep, at the archive, kcow.com/thetreatment. Stay with us. From Santa Monica, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I guess it's probably appropriate that my guest costume designer, Ellen Marochnik, worked on a film called The Greatest Showman, because so often in her work, we've discussed this when she was last here, there's a character who is kind of a show person, be it Michael Douglas or Sharon Stone, or in Oppenheimer, for which she was nominated for her first Academy Award. We're talking to Academy Award nominee Ellen Marochnik. It's a thrill to have her back. Thank you so much for coming back, Ellen.
Oh, it's a thrill to be here. Elvis, I cannot wait for us to have a chat.
When Chris Nolan and when Cillian Murphy were here, one of the first things I brought up to both of them was the way that you designed the look for Oppenheimer and for him specifically, and watching him grow up being that guy who was sort of wearing Brooks Brothers stuff to this guy who started creating a mythology in visual terms for himself, didn't he?
I thought that was really kind of fascinating about his character, because here was a man who was brilliant and a genius. And we saw Chris brought to life exactly what was going on in his head, that chaos that ran through his whole entire being continually, his fragility, his insecurities, all of what his soul was like shaking with. But as he began to grow, after his tour in Europe, in schooling, and all through Germany, and he came back to the United States and took on teaching at Berkeley, he began to grow into himself. As we see in the film, there's only one or two students at the very, very beginning, and all of a sudden he becomes hugely popular in his practices and what he's teaching. His chaos still existed. That fragility and chaos of his humanness doesn't go away. He is just becoming a little bit more accustomed to being amongst others and so on. And there is a point at Berkeley where he does become popular and becomes the Svengali, if you will. And it was time to actually help him appear to be the man. I'll just call it that for now, the man and the leader, but also that others followed. And I think that that particular moment, as I remember correctly, we changed the palette for him. I remember Chris loving the idea of a Cary Grant moving across the campus and such, and kind of picking a tone of gray that was quite light, actually, and singular for him. And it was at that point that he, as Robert Oppenheimer, began to become a bit more comfortable, a bit more confident, a bit more included, and not so alone in his thoughts and his chaos. The chaos that just, I cannot imagine all of that abstractness going on inside continually. It's a continual rhythm that Ludwig actually picked up so magnificently in the film. Another piece I just have to say.
You're talking about Ludwig Göransson.
Yes, absolutely. Genius. But as you might remember, it is very early on in the film where Kenneth Branagh says to Oppenheimer, "But do you hear the music?" And do you hear the music? To me, as an artist, and I think to all of us who are artists, is something that is the most absolute sentence that someone could say in terms of creation.
That's the point at which he connects to the rest of the world. He comes outside of himself a little bit. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about in costume terms, too, is he literally puts on a layer of calm. It hasn't calmed him at all, but he's learned how to dress so that people can look at him and not see the chaos, not see a guy whose shirt and tie don't match and the clothes look like they picked him out running out the door. And I wanted to talk to you about your first conversations with Chris Nolan about mm-hmm. this, because it's got to be a real pleasure for you to like walk somebody and walk the audience through this emotional development of a character through wardrobe.
It was a very, very great conversation, our first conversation. It came after, I think, three reads of the script and trying to really digest all of what Chris had so exquisitely written. It was a script that was written in the first person, as we now know, and that was something that was I'd never read before as a script. It was both epic and so very intimate at the same time.
Well, it's finally a melodrama. It really yeah, is. It's almost a Douglas Sirk film in a lot of ways.
You know, you're absolutely right, Elvis. It was just the most exquisite, greatest experience of my life. Our first conversations were very, very, very focused and informative. And because Chris's vision was very, he knew what his vision was. I had never worked with Chris Nolan before. And so it's interesting when you first begin to work with someone to see if how you get along, number one, how you learn each other's language, how you learn to read beyond the language, and do you hear the music? And if, in fact, you can agree and add to a vision that you know is going to be very precise. How can you contribute to that vision and bring it to life? And so his first conversations, for the very first meeting that we had, it was with Chris and Emma.
Emma Thomas, his wife,
his
producer, partner.
Brilliant partner, producer, and wife. And on this very, very long conference table, we had every image that you could imagine of Oppenheimer. Interesting, they're all in black and white. No images in color. I think in the very end of our meeting, we did find one image in color. But to this day, I don't know if it was a colorized version on a magazine cover. But everything was black and white. I had looked at images quite in depth prior to this meeting. But looking at them all on a table, only Oppenheimer, you could see, and I've mentioned this before, a very consistent silhouette that ran from the beginning of his teachings, not the young years, but when he went to Berkeley, he was still young, but when he went to Berkeley, through the end of his life. And that was kind of very interesting to me because the things that shifted, why it looked like it shifted, his face looked thinner to me, and I thought the fragility had come back over time. So things looked proportionately correct, but they looked as if there were years in which they looked bigger. The jackets looked bigger. They looked more draped, more voluminous in the trousers. And then we saw images on this table of David Bowie. And those images of David Bowie were images that Chris had sent very early on, I think maybe even before Killian had read the script.
Yeah, I talked about, I mentioned that I said this Bowie in the Thin White Duke period. He goes,
exactly.
Absolutely. Yes.
Exactly. It was shocking. It was shocking. This is 40 years later, right? Or 30. But the proportion is so similar. It's crazy. But, you know, just as an aside, when I've been with actors, when you mention the name David Bowie and you show images of David Bowie, everybody's on board.
Of course, it's always interesting talking to my guest, Academy Award nominee Ella Marajnik. Her most recent film was a collaboration with Christopher Nolan. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. And we talked about this when I first had you here, for another actor who you led to an Academy Award, Michael Douglas, on mm-hmm. Wall Street. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, I think those silhouettes are not dissimilar. The shape of the pant being both sort of like
yes.
to grab attention, but also so you can move in them.
Well, there's a certain swagger. That's what I call it. There's a voluminous to it. However, what I love about
but
that...
But it's not shapeless.
It's quite shaped. What I love about it is that the waist is high. And I know Killian and Oppenheimer loved it. He still loves it to this day. He loves wearing trousers that are high-waisted. But what happens there is that when it sits on your waist properly and you have that fabrication that moves, that's pleated and full, and it moves around your legs, there is a certain elegance and swagger that you cannot help but have part of your body language. It's right there.
Both the character that Douglas played in Wall mm-hmm. Street and Killian's character, obviously Oppenheimer, in Oppenheimer, where in the center of the room, you see who he is. And I was really fascinated in watching the costuming between Einstein, between Tom Conti, Killian Murphy, and Robert Downey Jr. Those three outfits alone told so much story. And you must have had so much fun doing that.
This has been an extraordinary experience because designing these characters, you know, they're based in history. Okay, so we know what it is in history. But Chris said very, very early on very early on in that meeting at that table looking at all of Oppenheimer. He said, listen, Ellen, there are a couple of things. Number one, I don't want a precious movie. I don't want a stylized movie. I said, okay. Number two, Oppenheimer is the only one that wears a hat. There is an exception, but he is the only one in the film that wears a hat. And number three, I like authenticity without a question of a doubt. You should stay in authenticity. It's not a documentary, but you stay in authenticity. But if you can find a way to add a modernity to these characters, I think it would be great. So those three pieces, that's the brief that leads you to discovering all of these elements in terms of breaking down and designing the characters, or what my adaptation of what I'm seeing between the actor and the image, the real image, should actually become. Because when dealing with the actor, you're dealing in proportion, you're dealing with the actor, you're dealing in the needs of the actor, etc. But these actors were absolutely so 100% committed, and so much the vessels. They came into the room empty and they wanted to be filled, and they wanted to play, and they wanted to find each and every element that the characters that they were portraying would bring to life, and how I could help them bring them to life.
I mean, so often in these things, I mentioned The Greatest Showman, but there's basic instinct, and the power is not in Michael Douglas's detective character, it's in Sharon Stone's character. This thing you're talking about, the shoulder with the drape.
Yes.
And the silhouette, and a lot of that thing is crepe de chine that she's wearing because of the way it falls.
Yeah.
But you also have a finer weave of, it seems to me, of flannel, so it doesn't bunch. And it's not as rigid as flannel normally is. So it has that kind of movement.
There's a softness to it and a hardness at the same time. And frankly, that, and saying there's a softness and a hardness at the same time is the key to it, is the key to not only creating the costume, but creating the character and creating that power and not showing it. There is a journey. There is a journey in the 30s to his power of 1942 when we see him in Los Alamos. You know, there is a journey that he takes as after Florence introduces him to the Gita. Now, I took it in a little bit of a spiritual manner. Florence's character, Jean Tatlock, introduces him to the Gita. And they talk about Lord Shiva and Prometheus and the fire. I could be wrong, but I believe he was in his early 30s at that time. Through his early 30s into moving into his power, when Matt Damon comes to visit and says, you're the man, he has known this. But, you know, in the meantime, he has assumed a power. He has kind of found that if he creates this look, not dissimilar to Bowie, he becomes a little bit more powerful and a ladies' man. He was brought up in a privileged house. He was accustomed to the finer things in life. His father actually imported fine fabric from Europe. So he knew of that quality and cloth. He didn't have to find that. He just had to cull it, bring it together, and cull the finest things in life.
I'm going to ask you as a last question here, because I mentioned that you're costuming for Michael Douglas. I'm sorry, I'm going to say this to you. Led him to the Academy Award, and the same thing happened with Cillian Murphy on Oppenheimer. How does that feel?
It feels great. It really feels great. I feel as if, well, I did my work. I mean, I heard the music and I did my work. I'm not joking about this. I am really so honored to have collaborated with both of those men and created something, an iconographic image. No, it's not an iconogram. But no, it's more than that. It's the iconography of Gordon Gekko, of Oppenheimer. I tear up. I'm not joking, because there is a feeling of completeness and contribution that I think is an important element of my job in bringing that to the culture and what we see. I just feel that these men have actually embodied all that they had hoped for and then some.
My guest is Academy Award nominee Ellen Mirage. I think it's a pleasure to say that and a pleasure to have her back here. It's always good to talk to you, Ellen. Thanks
always
so much.
Always good to talk to you, Elvis. It's a pleasure.
Costume designer Ellen Mirajnik, whose work includes this year's Best Picture, Oppenheimer, for which she was nominated for the Oscar, and I think one of the reasons Cillian Murphy won for Best Actor. Okay, Christopher Nolan may have had something to do with it, too. Sir Patrick Stewart with The Treat, which for him will always be a contender, is next. Other treats centered on those fighting to stay in contention at kcrw.com/thetreat. It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Sir Patrick Stewart's memoir, Making It So, an examination of the path he traveled to becoming an actor, is a veritable treasure trove of influences. But in this book, he mentioned a moment that changed his life. From a movie about family, kinda, that he explains further.
Hello, I'm Patrick Stewart, and this is A Treat. I've been asked a question about something that had a big impact on me, and I reflected only on the fact that there were too many things like that, but actually there were two, and they must have happened in the same year. In that year, when I was 13, I saw Elia Kazan's production of On the Waterfront. And I'd never seen a film like that before. When I arrived at the cinema that day and saw it was in black and white, oh, I was so disappointed, because I'd become obsessed with Technicolor. I loved it. I'd become obsessed with Technicolor and Doris Day.
You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit, so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You know how I got in to see On the Waterfront? I did what I did with all films that I wanted to see that I wasn't old enough to see. I would wait until an adult, I always hoped for a couple, but sometimes it could be just one person, would come in to buy a ticket, and I would say to them, look, here's the money. Would you mind buying a ticket for me? And I've come with you, and then I won't bother you anymore. And people would, at least in my community, would say, yeah, sure, of course, come on. And they'd get the ticket, they'd give me the ticket, and I'd go and sit on my own somewhere. It had an impact. I've always said that he shouted out as Brando, horribly beaten up and blood pouring down over his face and staggering along to get back up onto the quayside. And just as he arrives there, you hear the foreman yell out, "Everybody works today!" And because we'd seen him earlier hand-picking people, you know, and, well, I've been misquoting that all this time. But I heard that, and it had, I just feel so lucky. And then it was about that time that an English teacher, my English teacher, Cecil Dormant, said to me, "The work you're trying to do, Patrick, is inside you. all you really have to do is release it. Let it out. Now, those sound like very abstract words, but to a 13-year-old who felt uncomfortable around other 13-year-olds and much more comfortable around adults, it was a life-changing experience.
The movie On the Waterfront from Sir Patrick Stewart, The Treat, which featured an actor he later worked with, Rod Steiger. More details in his book, Making It So. Past treats such as David Oyelowo on a filmmaker and friend, Making It So, at kcrw.com/thetreat. A scene that stays with one forever, be it a live moment on the stage, or one propelled by words from the page, or flickering across the big screen, or perhaps observed from real life, the kind of drama that aerates the soul and the imagination. It's The Treat. The show is produced and edited almost in real time this week by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. So much help this week from Laura Kondarajan, Sue Margulies, and Phil Richards. So much to say about eating this week from Evan Kleinman and Good Food, which is next. Into better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.